Hello, and thanks for turning on The Blender, the new weekly podcast from Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. It's the only international broadcaster featured in a song by REM. I'm Daisy Sindelar, a writer at RFERL, and I'll be your host this week. In this podcast, we bring you Uncovered, a look at some of the most important stories coming out of RFERL's bureaus this week. Well, some are important, and some slightly less.
They were very serious about wanting to have the biggest flag, and they did for a long time, but apparently the wind has been a little too much for it to keep flying, and they're going to have to either get some stronger material or a stronger flagpole, it looks like.
We'll also look back at the legacy of the band that brought disco fever to the once cold and clammy dance halls of the Soviet bloc. I'm talking, of course, about Boney M., a band so popular, they've got knockoffs in every language. But first, as uncertainty mounts in Egypt, a look at how the recent wave of Middle East uprisings may be worrying the autocratic leaders of Central Asia and Azerbaijan. RFERL's Jeremy Branston has the story.
This was the sound heard for days in Cairo's central Tahrir Square. And this was the sound more than 1,200 miles away, near the Azerbaijani capital of Baku. Azeri opposition politicians, emboldened by massive anti-government protests in Egypt, calling on their own despotic leader, Ilham Aliyev, to resign. All along the southern tier of the former Soviet Union, people have watched with rapt attention as events in Egypt unfold. In countries like Azerbaijan, Kazakhstan, and Uzbekistan, people are now looking at their own autocratic leaders, most already in power for decades, and wondering if they might fall to the same fate as Egypt's Hosni Mubarak, whose 30-year rule appears almost certain to end as a result of the massive public uprising. Ali Karimli, the head of the opposition Azerbaijan Popular Front Party, says the recent wave of public protests across Tunisia, Yemen, and Egypt are eye-opening for many people who believed the Arab world would be the last place to witness people power movements forcing concessions from their leaders. He says Aliyev, who has erected a statue of Mubarak in Baku and nurtured close ties with a number of Arab leaders, should take note.
All of Azerbaijan saw how comfortable Ilham Aliyev felt when he met with Arab dictators. He established good contacts with them, and he saw these countries as a model for Azerbaijan. Now everybody who looked to those countries as a model is probably disappointed. Looking at these developments, you can conclude that global democracy building can now speed up so that there will be no asylum country for dictators.
In Kazakhstan, the country's long-standing leader, Nursultan Nazarbayev, this week appeared to draw a lesson from Egypt when he suddenly scrapped a referendum on prolonging his rule for another decade, calling instead for early presidential elections. But advisors to Nazarbayev have rejected the notion that echoes of the Egypt scenario would ever be felt in Kazakhstan, which they say has managed to address the question of living standards and poverty in a way that Egypt has not. But Rustem Lebekov, the director of the Eurasian Center for Political Studies in Almaty, says that while events in the Middle East may not have an impact on ordinary Kazakhs, they have definitely set off alarm bells in the halls of power.
Our people are largely apolitical. They are not particularly interested in politics, especially in political events abroad. What's going on in the Middle East has more impact on the local elite. These events frighten those in power because people start drawing parallels.
Nazarbayev is one of the longest ruling autocrats in Central Asia. The others are Emomali Rahmon of Tajikistan and Islam Karimov, whose rule over Uzbekistan is considered one of the most repressive in the world. There, state-run media have given only summary coverage of the events in Egypt, and the few newspaper commentaries that have appeared on the topic have warned that ousting Middle Eastern leaders would create a void that could only be filled by radical Islam, citing the current reemergence of the banned Muslim Brotherhood Party in Egypt. But Central Asia experts like Eric McGlinchey, a professor of political science at George Mason University in the U.S., says Karimov and others are playing the Islamist card as a way of tamping down public anger over corruption and poverty. Besides, he says, there's a far greater threat to the Central Asian regimes than either spillover from Egypt or rising radical Islam, and it's something that neither 72-year-old Karimov nor 70-year-old Nazarbayev can do anything about.
There's also another thing that's coinciding with this at the same time, and that is, in Nazarbayev and Karimov's case in particular, these guys are old. They're getting older and older and older. Now, they might not die tomorrow, but what happens when these guys are getting older is the expectation of some kind of transfer of power increases, and that injects uncertainty into the situation that hadn't existed before.
It's this situation, McGlinchey says, that's the ultimate destabilizer. An aging leader attempting to hold on to power as the political elite around him jockey for position in whatever regime comes next. In Azerbaijan, 49-year-old Ilham Aliyev may feel the problems of his autocratic elders are some ways off. Aliyev inherited the presidency from his father, Haydar, and has shown every intention of passing it on to his son, also named Haydar. His control over the country and its ample resources are nearly complete. But ordinary Azerbaijanis, like this man in Baku, suggest that events in Egypt may fuel calls for an end to Azerbaijan's political dynasty.
Mubarak has been in power for 30 years. That's enough. Let another man come and rule the nation. The same is taking place in our country. One dynasty will spend 30 or 40 years in power, but in the end, they'll be overthrown.
In the meantime, the statue of Mubarak in a central Baku park and songs like Building Our Peace, written by Mubarak's wife Suzanne and performed by a popular Azerbaijani singer, may serve as increasingly uncomfortable reminders that even firm friendships and firm leaders may not be enough to prevent change from coming to Egypt, Azerbaijan, or Central Asia.
When I try to song for peace and sing it loud and clear, a world's in need of love and care. It's time to build our peace. Step by step, we'll make things right. Let the wind up spreading with some guy.
That was Jeremy Branston reporting on the Middle East uprisings and their repercussions in Central Asia and Azerbaijan. You're listening to The Blender, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's new weekly podcast. And now for a segment we're calling Uncovered. It's a look at some of RFERL's best original reporting on underreported stories. Brian Whitmore sat down with Intrepid editors Merhat Sharabjan and Pete Baumgartner to hear about the notable news coming out of RFERL's bureaus this week.
Belarus has been very much in the news in recent weeks, and just recently the European Union has imposed sanctions on 158 high Belarusian officials and supporters of the regime. There was some response out of Minsk on that this week. Pete, you want to tell us about it a little bit?
Yeah, the response from many Belarusians who have been banned from entering Europe has been quite surprising, actually, Brian. For instance, the doctor where a presidential candidate was recovering from a severe beating he took, when KGB officers came in and actually removed him forcibly from his bed, that doctor has been banned, and he says he doesn't really care because he doesn't travel to the EU and doesn't have any business there, so he doesn't seem too bothered by that.
Is that a widespread sentiment among the Belarusian officials?
Well, some other officials in Belarus have said the same thing, and this ban actually affects journalists. It affects members of the Central Election Committee, a lot of the government officials, of course, including President Lukashenko. And they've up to now have said that this isn't really affecting them in a big way.
I just want to add one thing here. It's one of the funniest statements made by one of those who is banned from entering the European Union is a former member of Belarusian Parliament, Mr. Sergei Kasyan, who said that European Union's decision to impose sanctions against Belarus is medieval savagery. So it sounds a bit funny because if you compare what the Belarusian regime did to opposition activists and their supporters in December, it looks more savagery to me than the sanctions imposed against the officials.
Yeah, I think we can all agree with that, Mercat. Moving into another story that popped up this week, it's a little bit of an odd one. In the Russian city of Kirov, which was expecting a visit from Prime Minister Vladimir Putin, some strange leaflets appeared in for the members of the town. Mirka, you want to tell us a little bit about that story?
Yeah, that story happened in the town of Kirov. It's a very important city in the European part of Russia. The leaflets started being distributed among the citizens living in the central Moscow street. And the leaflets were instructions how to behave themselves while Premier Putin is in town. Namely, people were instructed not to look out of the windows, keep all the windows closed and curtained, saying that nobody is supposed to take pictures and use binoculars or cameras in order to avoid sniper attacks from the security of Putin, Putin's cortege. In the end, the whole story ended with the shame the leadership of the police in the city had to apologize publicly. And investigations were launched, and it turned out that officially it was reported that it turned out that a captain of local police initiated this himself and decided to do this kind of measures of security while Prime Minister Vladimir Putin was expected to the town.
Is there any indication whether this guy was just made a scapegoat for something that was general police policy, or was this some rogue officer getting overzealous?
Well, as far as I know, in the former Soviet Union, especially in Russia, usually this kind of stories end with the acquisition of one or two individuals who are usually scapegoats.
Uh-huh. Okay. Now, moving on to the lighter side, I understand that the country of Azerbaijan has the largest flag in the world, and that flag had an interesting experience this week, Pete.
It's actually the largest flag that is flying. And it was flying, except for the flagpole got bent apparently by the wind, and they had to take it down. So when they put it up last year, they had beaten out a flag that exists in Turkmenistan, that was up to that time the largest flag in the world, and then Azerbaijan had this one that is actually it's huge. It's 70 meters long. 35 meters wide, and it weighs 350 kilos.
It's one big flag.
Amazingly, it cost $24 million to create. So they were very serious about wanting to have the biggest flag, and they did for a long time, but apparently the wind has been a little too much for it to keep flying, and they're going to have to either get some stronger material or a stronger flagpole, it looks like.
Well, that'll be another line for next year's budget, I suppose, in that oil-rich country. And we got a little bit more time for one more story, and I want to bring us to Ukraine, which has changed very dramatically since the election of President Viktor Yanukovych and has moved in a much more authoritarian direction, as the residents of the town of the city of Kharkiv have learned, Mirka. What's going on there?
Yeah, in the eastern city of Kharkiv, which is the second largest city in the country, the local human rights activists sent an open letter to President Yanukovych urging him to curb police. It turned out that in Kharkiv, in 10 days, two suspects jumped from a police station's fourth and third floors, just in 10 days from the same building. And in one case, there was a man representing a Roma community. His mother said that he was beaten, and the police threw him from the window to cover up the beating. In the second case, a young lady confessed of stealing some amount of potatoes and also jumped. The human rights activists say it looks like police got green light to do whatever they want to do. The situation, they say, is getting worse, even though torture always was used by police in Ukraine.
Now, this problem has gotten a lot worse after the former president, the pro-Western Viktor Yushchenko, has left power, and the more pro-Moscow Viktor Yanukovych came to power following the last elections. Is that accurate? Has police brutality gotten worse in Ukraine in this period?
Well, according to the human rights activists, this is the case. And also, if you take into account that the recent events in Kyiv, when the opposition and human rights activists tried to organize mass actions of protest, the police were more brutal than it used to be during the Yushchenko regime. And also, the criminal cases were launched against opposition activists. They are accused of destroying state property by setting tents in the Maidan or Independence Square in Kyiv during their protest actions.
Well, God, I remember in the early 90s sitting in the Maidan drinking beer and listening to kids playing guitars, and nobody ever accused us of destroying state property. That's about all the time we have for today. Thank you, Mercat, and thank you, Pete.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
For more original reporting on underreported stories, check out the From Our Bureau section on RFERL's English language website at rferl.org.
З вами Радіо Свобода.
Радіо Фарда Кушніка.
Айче Радіо Європа.
Машал Радіо.
Азатить Радіо.
Азатицюн КТМ.
28 languages, 21 countries, one voice. Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty.
And now, a look back at Boney M., the German-produced musical act that first brought disco to the Soviet bloc. Boney M. never made it big in the U.S., but the group's signature style and groovy dance moves remain hugely popular in Russia and other post-communist countries to this day. The band's frontman, Bobby Farrell, died in late December of heart failure after a concert in St. Petersburg. I sat down with some fellow Boney M. fans to discuss the band's impact in the Soviet Union and beyond. I'm in the studio today with David Kakabadze, the director of RFERL's Georgian service, and Mossadegh Khatouzian, who does much of our cultural programming for our Iranian service, Radio Farda. And we're also joined on the line by our New York correspondent, Nick Krestev, a native of Bulgaria. And gentlemen, I want to thank you for taking time out of your busy schedules to sit and talk about basically the world's greatest band that some people have never heard of, Boney M. Now, Boney M. was a Western band. The cast of characters changed from time to time, but the basic format was three women and one man, all from various Caribbean nations, and their act was kind of the creation of a German impresario, Frank Farian. And they were pretty popular in Western Europe during the late 1970s, during the height of the disco craze. But the place where they achieved truly legendary status was behind the Iron Curtain. And even now, if you go to Russia or Poland or Bulgaria, you can still hear Boney M. being played, and people seem to spontaneously jump up and dance like crazy whenever they hear one of these songs. There's an incredible affection for this band. And we'll listen to a couple of their songs in just a minute, but I wanted to start by asking you, David, if you remember where you were when you first heard Boney M.
I remember it exactly, because it was New Year's Eve, 31st of December, 1976, and I was watching TV, so it was quite common in the Soviet Union that on the New Year's Eve, after 12 o'clock, everybody sat in front of TV sets and watched. And even if I was 17 at that time, I was among those who sat in front of the TV set. Because in Georgia, there used to be a musical show, and it was a kind of legendary person for Georgia, because he managed somehow to present musical pieces and videos to the people, which were forbidden in the Soviet Union. And this was a talk show. This was a show called Estrada da Tana Medrovova, which means pop music and modern times, if you translate into English. And it had to be also critical, obviously. So he had to tell stories about those musicians, whoever he presented, say something bad about the capitalist world, and then present the video itself. So everybody knew that this person didn't really mean what he was saying, but for him this was the only way to educate people. And so this was the, let's say, 1st of January 1977, when I first heard Boney M., and it was the song Sunny. And this song really became a hit in Georgia. I had a classmate, for instance, who had a video recorder and who had recorded this song. And we were going to him and listening again and again, even if I personally was not a fan of disco music. But this song really, really fascinated me.
Nick, what about you? Now, I know you have a real affection for this group because when Bobby Farrell, the group's frontman, died in late December, you dashed off an appreciation of Boney M. before anyone even thought to ask. You wrote, "Boney M.'s true home was in the dimmed halls of the early disco clubs of the Soviet Union, Bulgaria, and Poland. There, local DJs would pump up songs like Rivers of Babylon and Daddy Cool on low-quality East German-made reel-to-reel tapes. And the crowd, which remained stubbornly inert as long as the Komsomol-sanctioned tunes were playing, would suddenly erupt back to life on the dance floor." It's a great description. And I want to know, was that your introduction to Boney M.? Were you listening to a reel-to-reel tape as a teenager in a Sofia disco club?
Yeah, I was in a disco club, one of the few disco clubs at that time in Bulgaria. And they were playing that kind of a lame music called estrada. But occasionally the DJs will play something livelier. And I think the first song I heard of Boney M. was Daddy Cool, which was a very danceable tune. And it was definitely in a contradiction to a few songs that they played before that. And I remember I was like 15 years old at the time. And we just erupted. I mean, we just started dancing because it was like so infectious.
Sadak, I'm going to turn to you now. I waited before coming around to you because your experience with Boney M. is a little bit different. You grew up in Iran, and in the 1970s, when you were a teenager in Tehran, before the Islamic Revolution, there weren't the same kinds of limitations on what you could listen to like there were behind the Iron Curtain. And yet, Boney M. was hugely popular there as well. And I guess I may have assumed, somewhat unfairly, that Boney M. was popular in the Soviet Union because there wasn't that much Western music to choose from. But you argued that it was actually a little bit different, that young people in Iran, like yourself, really thought this was the best music to be had in its genre.
The feeling that we had at that time listening to Boney M. was that it was a unique music. It was uplifting and energetic and upbeat, and like both David and Nick were saying, kind of like dance music. Even ABBA, such as, you know, a song such as Dancing Queen, you know, which was upbeat, could not compare with the beat of Boney M. Daddy Cool, like, you know, Nick said, was the first song that I heard from them, and it was like, what is this?
Talking to you briefly before this, you sort of challenged all of my preconceived notions about Boney M. because, one, I'd never imagined that they would be popular in Iran. And the second thing was that, as an American, I was convinced that they were not popular in America, that no one had ever heard of Boney M. I never heard of Boney M. until I traveled to Russia, and then I was indoctrinated. But you had the unusual experience of moving to Lawrence, Kansas in the 70s and attending college there, and you said that Boney M. was pretty popular.
That's right. That was in 1978 when I got there, and I can vividly remember the, you know, sound of, let's say, Ma Baker coming out of fraternities around, you know, the center of KU campus. And in fact, I was used as an extra, my first job in the United States, as an extra in a disco, and they were playing that, and we had to dance with it. They were playing Ma Baker and Daddy Cool and lots of other pieces of music that were upbeat in that way.
Freeze! I'm Ma Bob Baker, put your hands in the air and give me all your money.
This is the story of my baker, the meanest cat from old Chicago town.
Yeah, I just wanted to include the beginning because a lot of Boney M. songs have these kind of spoken voice interludes that are so bizarre, but people find them really delightful. That's probably the best one. So let's take a listen to the lyrics. Boney M. broke up, sadly, in 1986, but different members of the band have continued to tour almost nonstop, particularly in the former Soviet Union. And David, Boney M. even had a pretty high-profile performance in Georgia not long ago, is that right?
That's right. It was shortly before the August War, 2008. And they performed in a village called Tamarasheni, which is on the territory of self-proclaimed South Ossetian Republic. And it was a Georgian-populated village, and it was a village which the Georgian government kind of tried to develop in a contrast to Tsikhinvali, which is a capital of that region. And it's very, very close to Tsikhinvali, I think 10 kilometers maybe. And they built there a very nice movie hall, very, very nice roads and all kinds of things which usually residents of a village in Georgia don't have the privilege to enjoy. And they, so the Georgian government even decided to organize a concert there. And they invited Boney M. I guess this was the last point when the Russians realized that something wrong is going on there and they have to somehow, I don't want to go into politics, but somehow stop this development of Georgian villages in South Ossetia.
We're going to end by listening to what is perhaps one of the greatest kitsch classics of all time. And of course, I'm talking about the song Rasputin, which is about the Russian mystic Grigory Rasputin. Bobby Farrell and the rest of Boney M. really loved Russia. So for Boney M. fans, there's a kind of uncanny synchronicity to the fact that Bobby Farrell died in the same city, St. Petersburg, and on the same day, December 29th, as Rasputin. And Nick, I'm going to give you the last question. What do you think? Would Bobby Farrell have appreciated the circumstances of his death?
That's a good question, and it's hard for me to answer. I don't know. I mean, if he really appreciates that, I don't know that would he like the fact, but I mean, this is what happened. And I think it's a kind of a twist of fate, an irony, but this is what happened. So we have to take it at its face value.
And that's all we have for this week. I'm Daisy Sindelar, and thanks for turning on the blender from Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. We'll take you out with a little rah-rah Rasputin.